My name is Ken Rayner, and I work at the library in the Community Relations Department. And I would like to welcome everybody here tonight. Thank you for coming out to see the program, which is Committed to the Deep. Joel Stone, curator of the Detroit Historical Society, will be talking about shipwrecks of the Great Lakes and exploring the Great Lakes underwater treasures. Without further ado, please help me welcome Mr. Stone.
Thank you, Ken. Let me set that down for a minute. I'd first like to say, as we get started, that I really love libraries. I'm kind of making a tour of libraries, so it's a good thing I like libraries, but I like libraries enough that I married a librarian. So they're very high on my list. I'm not sure. The Detroit Historical Society, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. It's an organization that handles two museums and a quarter of a million artifacts. We kind of took over the management of the historical properties from the city of Detroit a few years ago, and we run the Detroit Historical Museum on Woodward, right there in the Cultural Center. We run the Dawson Great Lakes Museum, which is on beautiful Belle Isle, and we run the collections, which is stored at historic Fort Wayne. I don't know if you folks are familiar with this. How many are familiar with this? This is one of the greatest inventions of this century so far. It's a museum pass that you can get upstairs for free, and it'll get you into museums all over southeastern Michigan. It really is a wonderful thing. I say that with a caveat. The Dawson Museum is free all the time. Of course, all the time is only Saturday and Sunday right now. We're hoping to extend the hours, but Saturday and Sunday, 11 to 4. Free all the time. This will get you into the main museum anytime, and that's open Wednesday through Sunday. Enough with the first half of my spiel. Tonight we're going to be discussing exploring underwater treasures. And I've already talked to some of the folks in the audience before as you were coming in, and it seems many of you are interested in boats, which is probably why you're here. But in particular, one of the reasons we put this exhibit, and it is based on an exhibit that we've got at the Dawson Museum right now, is that when you say shipwrecks, people come in the door, okay? If I had said this is all about underwater archaeology and its techniques, not so many people in the door. So we say shipwrecks, but what we're really going to be talking about is a whole sea change that has taken place in wreck preservation and the understanding of shipwrecks as a historical tool probably in the last 20 years, I would say. If we think about it, diving is a relatively new sport. It's a relatively new science, basically developed after World War II, became a recreational thing for those people who were interested in the 60s. And back in the 60s, the idea was to find the wreck and bring up some cool stuff and put it on your mantle. And it was cool. I mean, it really was. I remember those days and going into somebody's house and seeing something up there, a binnacle, or seeing a wheel above their fireplace or something. That was really darn cool. Unfortunately, and I'll get into this later, but unfortunately, by taking that off of there, the divers had ruined the scientific aspect of it, that it could be used by anthropologists and archaeologists and historians to tell different things. Over the last 20 years, that's changed entirely, and that's essentially what we're going to talk about. Now, if I say shipwrecks on the Great Lakes, what's the first boat you think of? Everybody knows this song. Everybody in Nebraska knows this song. The song is greatly, widely known. Frankly, I'm not sure that Gordon Lightfoot didn't do us a disservice with this song. It's essentially two measures over and over and over again. And if you've ever tried to sing it, the poetry is rather stiff. It's hard to sing the poetry, which isn't bad, with the music, which isn't good. And putting the two together. Now, that being said, Gordon Lightfoot did two things. He brought a real humanity to the people that sail on the boats. And in this case, the people who lost their lives on the boats. He really did that. And he raised the profile of the Great Lakes and the profile of the Great Lakes shipwrecks. So for those two things, I'm very thankful to him. The Great Lakes, an incredible body of water, and it's a body of water we don't take, I mean, many of us take for granted. It's got its own characters. It's its own culture. By its very nature, the fact that it's five separate lakes, huge lakes, if you've ever been out on them, huge lakes, but based on their depth, based on their size, it's completely different than any other sailing in the world. It's got a wave action that's completely unlike the ocean. On the ocean, the waves are long. Waves are governed by wind, but they're also governed by depth. I mean, there's a lot of physics I don't understand involved in it, but waves on the ocean are relatively long. On the lakes, waves are pretty quick, and they're short, and they're very steep, so that you're going up, and instead of nice swells, you're really pitching quite a bit in any kind of an action, you know, even a light chop. On the ocean, if you get into a storm, you can run. You turn, and you run for days. In the lakes, if you turn and you run, you may have 4 or 5 hours before you got to figure something else out or you hit the beach. Rivers, lots of rivers. I mean, besides the St. Mary's, besides the Detroit and the St. Clair rivers, which are tricky, you've got things like the Cuyahoga and the Little Calumet over in Chicago, small rivers that require some real handling, some real skill, some boatsmanship. Shallow harbors, especially earlier on in the nature of the lakes maritime, the harbors themselves needed to be dredged all the time, and if the government didn't pay for it, it probably didn't get done, in which case the boats were built differently than they were on the ocean. Frequent stops. On the ocean, you load your boat and you go for 2 or 3 weeks before you have to unload it. Here, you load your boat, you go for two days if you're lucky, and you're unloading it. And, you know, it may take 2 days to unload a boat on the ocean. It may take 3 or 4 hours to unload a boat on the lakes. They've really got it down to a science. So you're parking the boat a lot, you're getting the boat away from the dock, and you've got to do all the work that is involved in unloading. And primary cargoes, you know, much of the ocean cargo has all gone to container ships now. You know, those truck-like things that they take on and set off pretty quick. But on the Great Lakes, it's essentially coal, ore, stone, cement, sand, things that we have now figured out a way to move very quickly. So it's a whole different nature to the Great Lakes than it would be on the ocean. Because of that, the nature of shipboard life is completely different too. It's a stable workforce generally. Around here, you may work on the same boat for years and years and years, which is not usually the way a case on the ocean. Chances are you also know the people that you're working with. They've been in the same local as you. They belong to the same lodges as you. Very often they come from the same town. When we lost the Bradley, it was underscored. We lost a whole half the men in the town in a night. Kind of a problem. That doesn't happen on the ocean. Government regulation here is very stiff. It's kind of a problem depending on where you're standing. But the government regulation is very good on the Great Lakes. And they eat well. They have good places to sleep. If you're riding in a Liberian freighter, chances are your bunk hasn't been cleaned in years, and it's very small. On the Great Lakes, it's like living in a hotel. And the safety factors are huge. Amenities and perks. Well, one of the perks is you get at least 4 months off during the winter by the very nature of it. You're also sailing close to home. If you've got to go to a graduation, if you've got to go to a wedding, you can probably do that. And those guys eat better than any sailors in the world. Okay, they're in port every other day at the very least. They can get fresh vegetables. They can get fresh food. If they want a pizza, the Westcott will deliver it to them as they go down the Detroit River. And there's a whole nomenclature that's adapted to the Great Lakes that's unlike the ocean. We call them boats. They can be 1,000 feet long, and you call them boats. They're not ships. Wheelsmen is the guy that steers, whereas in the ocean it would be a helmsman or a steersman. So the nature of the Great Lakes Maritime is completely different. Let's run through a few of the ships. If we're talking about shipwrecks, let's look at what the guys looking for wrecks are looking for. A general timeline of boats over the last 3-4 centuries. Canoes, an excellent source of transportation, tremendous source of transportation for what it was used for. Sailing ships came in and they had a generally European design for a long time, and then they adapted to the Great Lakes. Bulk carriers came in about 1830, 1840. self-unloaders and passenger packets, also a major part of the business. Canoes, they're light. You can build them on the side of any lake, and you can fix them on the side of any lake. Put a hole in it, you pull it up, you get some birch bark and some tar, and you got it fixed in a few hours, and you're on your way. Incredibly versatile. It'll carry up to 3 or 4 tons of cargo. Of course, you got to have a lot of people to move it, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. Early on, again, the European design ships. This would have been the Nancy that was built up near Mackinac. Well, it was built in Detroit. It was sailed first up near Mackinac. John Askin owned it. He was a Detroit trader. Brought it down to Detroit. The British confiscated it during the Revolutionary War, and they ended up burning it over in Georgian Bay. The USS Michigan, a revolutionary boat, the first iron-hulled ship in the U.S. Navy. And for a long time, it was the fastest boat in the U.S. Navy until after the Civil War. It was involved in all kinds of altercations, including the Civil War and the pirates of Beaver Island and the lumber robbers of Lake Michigan, and just all kinds of actions right up through the Second World War. It was finally scrapped, so the boat lasted 100 years. Schooners, topsail schooners, in this case a classic Great Lakes schooner, three-master, probably the most prevalent of boats. At any given time, 1870, there were 2,000 of these boats on the lakes, sailing up and down, mostly carrying lumber. They weren't very good with ore because it was really hard on their hulls, but they also carried a lot of grain. There was a variation on this, and I should mention the triangular foresail there. It was particular to the Great Lakes, called a ruffee. And the only place you'll find it is on the Great Lakes. Similar to that is the scow. If you look at this boat closely, you'll realize that the front end is dead flat. The back end is dead flat. The sides are dead flat. It's a slab. And these boats were built fast. They were built easy. You didn't have to be a master shipwright, a master carpenter to build these things. You could put them together. They were essentially like shoe boxes, mostly built out of green wood. If they lasted 10 years, the owners got more money out of them than they ever expected. They also were very hard to sail, so they lost lots and lots of these ships. Eventually, they found that by adding steam to a boat or just making the boat bigger, they could just turn it into a barge. Most of the schooners ended as barges, getting pulled in this manner by a tug. Once we got steam and you started getting strong tugboats, they'd pull them up and down the rivers. As we see here, this would have been the Detroit River just above Belle Isle, and the Champion, it's called the Champion, and their tow, it was probably the most famous lithograph about 1875, 1880, done by a Detroiter. It shows it, the Champion towing 8 schooners. 7 of them were full and 1 of them was empty, but it was the heaviest deadweight tow ever done on the Great Lakes. The thing that came out of this was they found that as you were towing them up and down the river, why bother letting them go? Just keep towing them. You get them there faster, you make money, and eventually that's what they do. And instead of a tugboat, they put a freighter on the front of it, kind of the precursor of our freighters. This was known as a lumber hooker. I've been told because you could pull up to the side of any creek and throw a hook on the bank and keep yourself there. That's what I've been told. But anyways, these hookers would tow through 2 or 3 barges, you know, that would have 2 or 3 men on them, and that's the way that they made lots of money. Lots of the barges got lost. Oddly enough, in storms, if the boat in the front let the barges go, very often the barges survived and the boat did not, which I think is just fair. An unusual type of craft that was on the Great Lakes, developed by Alexander McDougall. We called them whalebacks, and they were basically just cigar boats. They were rounded so that the idea was that the waves just passed right over the top of them, that they hardly even felt them. They weren't crashing. They're actually very stable boats. They were just very hard to unload, proved impractical. Canal tankers, these boats were made to run up and down the New York State barge canal. The pilot house and the mast, the pilot house actually telescopes into the hull, and the masts lay down flat so they can go under bridges and things like that. And then we get the classic straight decker, the Edmund Fitzgerald here, but hundreds and hundreds of boats just like this boat. Each of the hatches placed at a very same angle or same distance apart so that they could pull up to the ore docks in two harbors, or Duluth, Superior, Marquette, Escanaba, and the chutes would all come down right where the hatches were, and they could load these boats in a matter of an hour or two. And then when they'd get back down below, they could had devices that would unload them. That would take sometimes 2 days until they came up with this type of craft, which had its own self-unloading device, had a kind of a conveyor belt that ran through the hull and then up to the conveyor that was on the arm that could swing off to either side. The boat could unload itself. It didn't need any unloading gear. It could unload anywhere. It could pull up to any bank, any place, just like the hookers. And it could just pull that arm over and unload any cargo it's got wherever it's asked for. And now we've got huge vessels. These vessels just kept getting longer and longer, and now the longest vessel is 1,013 feet long. And they're just moving buildings. They're like huge warehouses. You know, I mean, that's 3 football fields. And again, these things can unload themselves in a few hours using that device. And they'll just pull up. You can see it in the St. Clair River sometimes near the Edison plant. They've got a hopper there and right next to the plant, and that guy just pulls up and sticks that arm right in the hopper, and it goes from one conveyor belt to another conveyor belt and off to the plant. I mean, it doesn't even stop on a pile. Going back just a little bit, I thought this was appropriate to use. There were car ferries that ran on Lake Michigan primarily, but they also ran on Lake Erie, and these carried railroad cars back and forth. It was just an extension of the railroad. And they ran for years and years and years until trucking, of course, put them out of business. But this was, and I should note that most of the ships we've been looking at have been wrecked. Marquette and Bessemer we talked about earlier this year. It was wrecked 100 years ago in December. And December, yes, is that right? Yeah, December. And Mr. McLeod, who I just have to point it out, his great-grandfather was the first mate, and his great-great-uncle was the captain. And we had a ceremony, which I'll explain a little later. This is also a car ferry, but this ran up at Mackinac. These guys had to deal much more with ice. This was an interesting design that was designed by a guy in Detroit, Frank Kirby, and he's the first guy that put a propeller on the front of an icebreaker, which actually would suck the water out from under the ice, collapse the ice, and then it was easy to break. And then we had smaller vessels. This is a classic lakes fishing tug. There's still many of these out there, but there used to be hundreds. This is one of the passenger packets that I mentioned. These were some of the earlier boats on the lakes, starting after Michigan became a state. After the Erie Canal opened and traffic grew incredibly, they would carry hundreds of people, and they would also carry all their baggage and all the stuff that were already there, that people already there wanted. So they were carrying bulk cargoes, they were carrying people, they were carrying all kinds of things. The Lady Elgin, of course, probably the most famous shipwreck, passenger wreck, on the lakes that actually happened in the lakes. The Eastland, we lost more people sitting in the Chicago River, but these guys actually were wrecked in Lake Michigan. And then some passenger liners that we'd had around here, like the Boblo boats and the Tajmu. The Tajmu used to run up and down from Detroit to Port Huron every day. It was a regular run. You'd go up to one of the parks or resorts up to the St. Clair River and stop in Port Huron if you wanted to, and then come all the way back, and you'd be home in the evening. It was relatively inexpensive. It was a nice way to spend the day, and in the days before air conditioning, getting on a boat like this that was traveling at about 10 knots and a nice cool lake breeze was a real nice way to spend the day. Of course, the boats got bigger. This is one of the big passenger steamers that ran out of Detroit, the city of Detroit 3. The only part really that remains of it is at the Dawson Museum, so I'm always happy to show this off. But this boat was, 400 feet long, would carry 600 passengers, had lots of staterooms, several restaurants, a band, places to go and relax. These were floating palaces. In fact, that would have been the inside, and you can see kind of the inside staterooms coming off the grand staircase there. So shipwrecks. Those are essentially the boats that we're looking for if we're looking for shipwrecks. It's hard to tell how many wrecks there are. First of all, the records in the early years were very sketchy. Boat names would transfer even after a wreck. Some of the records have been lost. It's just hard to put that together. It's also hard to decide what is a shipwreck. Lots of wrecks would sink, and then they'd go out and they'd raise them again. You know, did that count as a shipwreck? And in the storm of in 1913, some of the boats that got blown up on the beach were counted as shipwrecks during that storm, and yet some of them were floated and used again. So, depending on how you categorize them, 3,000. David Swayze, who's got a great website if you're really into looking at shipwrecks, Dave Swayze's done a wonderful job of cataloging. He says, 4,700. There are people that say up to 6,000 shipwrecks. So it's really that's kind of wide open. But leave it to say that if we go with the small number, with 3,000, and if you imagine that there's 10 or 15 people on average working on each of those boats, you can do the math and figure out how many sailors we've lost. And then we're not talking even the passengers that were lost in some of the packets and things like that. So it gets pretty rough out there. And you talk to Great Lakes sailors and they'll tell you they see this stuff all the time. There's a lot of times that the guy up at the wheel will turn around and the only thing he sees is the smokestack. And these, when you see pictures like this and you realize that this is a relatively calm day, couldn't have been too bad if the guy's out there taking a photograph. Imagine the kind of stuff that the Fitzgerald was going through and many other boats. Yeah, yep. Well, but because it's small, that means its waves are closer together and choppier, so that's kind of a problem. The first of the shipwrecks, the first big boat built on the Great Lakes, built by LaSalle back in 1679, it made one trip, not even a full trip. It made a half a trip, and then we're not sure about the rest. It sailed from Black Rock, where it was built. LaSalle built it there along European lines, and he sailed it over to Green Bay, where he had some traders waiting with a load of furs, and he loaded it up, and he sent it off. While he went south, he was heading for Chicago. Well, he was heading in the area of where Chicago is now. Later that day and into the next day, a big storm came up, and nobody's sure what happened to his ship. It has become the Holy Grail. I heard Holy Grail used for the Bessemer because it hasn't been found in 100 years, and that's kind of unusual on a small lake. But this has not been found, although they do find it about every 20 years. And they make some really convincing arguments that this is the boat. They'll go to the French government and get them to write off on it and that kind of thing, and sure, this sure looks like it might be. And very sincere people. The most recent is a gentleman from Virginia who has a summer home up north, and he believes he's found it right about where that arrow's pointing. And he's basing that on a projecting pole. There is something down there that looks like a log or a small telephone pole that he has located that he is convinced is the bowsprit of the ship, and then the rest of the ship has been silted over. And he's gone so far as it's gone to court, and you've probably read about this. This has been quite a case. He's gone so far as to get the French government involved, because, of course, it's their boat officially. And Michigan wishes to go out and do the surveying stuff. I don't think they're going to dig it up. I think they want to do some non-invasive survey, some electronic surveying. But he got France to bring a claim, and France, I think, is probably going to win it. It's going to come down pretty close for a couple of reasons. When the Savannah sunk over near France during the Civil War and it was found, the United States claimed it, and the French agreed. It was our boat, and we got it back. I think we gave the salvage and study rights to a university in France. LaSalle's other boat, the LaBelle, was found down in Texas near Galveston about 15 years ago, and they again brought up lawsuits as this went, and the French claimed that. And after the Savannah, the United States said, well, sure, you can have that. And France gave the salvage and the study rights, I think, to the Texas A&M. So there's precedent for this. I think the French will probably get control, and the guy from Virginia will get control of the site in order to do something with it. What he's going to do, we're not quite sure. He has done some carbon dating, and it does date to within the range. But then again, so would a log that had died during that time and floated out to the middle and gone to the bottom. So it's going to be interesting to see. They'll find it again someplace else relatively soon. Yes, that's his name. Steve Lippert is the gentleman. So the question is, once you find a boat, and Steve Lippert has gone to a lot of trouble, and a lot of people who look for these boats go to all kinds of trouble. In fact, there's a gentleman, Daryl, here, who does this kind of thing. He'll tell you the kind of trouble that they go to find these boats. And it can be as easy as walking down the beach. You can be, this is down near Ogden Dunes, and it's right there on the beach. You can walk up and touch it. You can sit on it. You can look at the way it was built. Essentially, we're guessing it's a schooner. I'm pretty sure it's a schooner. There's some question that it might have been involved in the Underground Railroad, but they haven't been able to document that. But it's right on the beach. Or sometimes you'll just look under the water, and it'll be there waiting for you. This one's up in Tobermory, and there's several of these wrecks right below the surface up in Little Tub. You can go right over them in your canoe and your kayak and take a look at them. But they're usually not this easy. Usually it takes going out and digging through old newspapers. Here's one that we've blown up a piece of. These two boats collided, and it was just off Menominee River opposite Middle Island. So if I'm looking for the wrecks, I can go out and, you know, kind of use those coordinates. That'll give me an idea of where to search. That's a possibility. This is a piece out of a logbook. This would have been 1856. And this guy had just left the Whalen Canal, and he's sailing up, and he passes what's left of a schooner with her lower mastheads out of the water about 6 to 10 feet, her main top mast set down, and I think he gives some idea of where it is. But if you took his log and you figured out how far he had sailed, what direction he was sailing, you would have a pretty good idea of where that ship was. So this is really old school. This is the way they used to do it, and they still do it. They try to get a basic idea of where a boat is, a particular boat. And then they start throwing in the technology. Okay, this is a sonar fish. This is a thing that you tow behind your boat, and it'll give you a picture of what's on the bottom. You can see the fish along the bottom there. There's a reel of electrical cable that then attaches into a computer. And it will give you, first to show you what it looks like if you're going along. Some people will tow a camera down just to give them an idea what they're going to run over. And if they keep the fish just far enough back from that, then they will see something like this as they travel by. And then they basically go back and forth until they find something. They call this mowing the lawn. And you just you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and you spend a lot of time out there not finding stuff. But as Daryl and I were saying, you know, even if you don't find something, you spent the day on the boat. can't be that bad. When they finally do get something, this is what a picture will look like coming out of there. They'll see some things that look, well, you can see kind of an underwater trench there. A wreck, clearly a man-made object off to the left, and then something that looks suspicious off to the right. If you've got really, really good equipment, and the conditions are perfect, you'll get something like this, where you can count the ribs in that boat, either one of those boats. You can almost tell where they hit. You can almost tell, you know, which way they hit the bottom, and you can tell what kind of boats they are. So if you know you're looking for a 200-foot schooner, at least one of those is going to come into the 200-foot schooner range. So the next thing is you go down and you take a look around. And this is, again, old school. This is the old way they used to do it, and this was a lot of work, and a lot of guys died doing this. They did this both diving wrecks and to build things like the Brooklyn Bridge, and even as late as the bridge up at Mackinac and the Ambassador Bridge, they would use things like this to go down and put in caissons. But that's kind of a tough way to go. They've improved that a whole lot. The person to the right there, pretty typical scuba stuff. And this will get you down to 100, 125 comfortably feet of water. And you can spend a fair amount of time there because, of course, you can go down pretty quick, but you got to come back up. Anybody that's done any diving knows that if you don't come up slowly, you get the bends. Once you get past 150 feet, you got to get into some pretty technical stuff, and they call it technical diving. The guy on the left is rigged for technical diving. He's carrying three different types of gases, and he will mix those gases in different amounts the farther he goes down. And this kind of stuff will get you down to easily 250, and I've heard more than 300, but you know, once you get down there, you're really treading thin because you probably have a very small window. There's only so much gas you've got. You can only be underwater so much time, and the farther down you go, the longer it takes to come up. So that, you know, there's trade-offs, but you can get to boats that you can't get to any other way except by using one of these things. This is the suit that dove on the Edmund Fitzgerald. The Fitzgerald's in about 530 feet of water, so this will get you down much farther. This is a hard shell suit. You know, the arms are articulated, but I don't think there's much movement there, and you're pretty dependent on the guy on the cable that's upstairs on the boat above you. You probably have a propulsion unit that you use with this kind of thing, but it's a camera or a light, yeah, or maybe both. A little bit more expensive, if you can go this way, is you get your own submarine. That'll get you down quite a ways, but for a whole lot more money, there is a cheaper way of going, and those are remotely operated vehicles, ROVs. This one actually is a shot of an ROV on the Titanic. And these things can go down thousands of feet, and they can do most of the things that a human at that depth could even imagine doing, and there's absolutely no danger to a diver. This is all monitored by people with computers and monitors up on a ship, and it's a real, real safe way of going to get the same, much of the same information. Once you've found a wreck and once you've realized the basic layout of it, the first thing you want to do, absolutely first thing you want to do is start documenting it. Especially these days, wrecks are changing very, very rapidly. The lake levels are going up and down. I don't think that's any different than it has been for 200 years. There has been a little bit of a change. Some of the lakes are about 2 feet lower than they have been traditionally. But the zebra mussels. The zebra mussels are taking over all our boats, and there's not a thing we can do about it. So if you can find a boat and it's in any kind of shape, document it quick before it's completely covered. There is a good thing. The deeper you go, the less the zebra mussels get to it. After about 100-125 feet, there's very little zebra mussel activity. But again, you're at the bottom end of what normal divers can dive at. So one way to document it is, again, you can do this by diving on it. You can do it with an ROV, but go down and take pictures. And then you take the pictures and you put them together and you've got kind of a mosaic of what a vessel looks like and a real good idea. You can make some great drawings off of this. You also can go down, especially in shallower water, and do a transect on it. Actually put down a center line, and that line would run from the bow to the stern, and then people would go along and mark how far things were off to the side before they move anymore, before their other divers get down there. And most divers are pretty darn careful, but even the most careful diver can stir up a wreck, can change the way things look. And remember, one of the things that archaeologists and anthropologists are looking at, anthropologists, of course, are looking for, and you'll often find it, you know, what were these people eating when the boat went down? And sometimes you will see, sometimes these things happen so fast that the guys are actually eating, and you can see what they were eating when the ship went down. But also, what angle? You can tell what angle the boat hit the bottom at by the way things fell and crashed. You know, and surprisingly, boats you think went down at the bow went down at the stern. And these are things you only find by looking at a wreck and analyzing it quickly. If you do bring stuff up, and sometimes we do bring stuff up, there's advantages to doing that. Sometimes things have obviously been misplaced. They've been moved out of their original position. There's nothing to lose by bringing them up if there's a story to be told or if there's a chance that they're going to be lost. I mean, if they're in real shallow water and you know the zebra mussels are going to get them, there are reasons to do that. Then you bring them up and you do some conservation and you do it fast. This is up at Alpena. At the preserve that they've got up there, we've got a great NOAA preserve up there, and they've got a beautiful museum. If you get a chance, the museum opened just a couple of years ago, and they've done a real nice job of interpreting all of the Great Lakes, but more importantly, the shipwreck aspect of it, because there's a great sanctuary up there. And these are things that they brought off of different wrecks in the sanctuary. Great job for underpaid college interns. We take advantage of them ourselves at the CRC. But you can imagine all the different things. And some of these things, I mean, you treat wood different than you treat metal different than you'd treat the marble that they're bringing up. And that's the science behind the conservation part. A great story that we tell in our exhibit, and you got to come down and see this. It's the story of the Alvin Clark, and I call it the Tale of Two Disasters. The Alvin Clark was a real nice little two-master, and it was basically trading in lumber between Green Bay and ports in Michigan. It was one of those lumber thieves that I was talking about earlier. But they were sailing back empty. They had gone back to Green Bay to pick up something, and so he was completely empty, no ballast, and they got one of those little squally winds that come along, and it just tipped the boat right over, and it filled with water and sank like that. And they were having dinner when it happened. Boat went down. The boat was 105 feet long. It went down in 105 feet of water, and it was on the bottom for 105 years. Guys who give presentations love numbers like that. But it sat on the bottom until a group of divers, well, actually some fishermen were out fishing with nets, and the nets got tangled, and they paid a guy who owned a bar in Menominee to go out, the guy in the center with the striped shirt, Frank Hoffman. They paid him to go out and get their nets back. And when he went out, he went down and came down on this schooner. And if you imagine, the schooner was in 105 feet of water, and it probably had about 80-foot masts. So he didn't have to go down very far to find these masts. And the farther he went down these masts, the more he realized that this boat was in absolutely perfect shape. I mean, it was as it had gone. The sails had deteriorated. Some of the mast hoops had sprung. So it wasn't in perfect shape, but it was as close as it could be. So he got a bunch of his diving buddies, and they started raising money, and they got a lot of people behind them. And they went out, and they raised the boat. They actually brought it up with bubbles on either side, and they got it into shallow water, and then they went out with these cranes. You got to remember, Menominee has a couple of shipbuilding companies there, so they had this kind of stuff.
I was there.
So were you really?
Yeah.
That must have been very cool. So then they went out, and they raised it between these cranes, and then they threw in some pumps, and they pumped the boat out, and tell me this is right, the boat floated.
Yeah.
There was nothing wrong with this boat.
It
just stayed floated. They didn't even have to. I mean, if you own a wooden boat, you know that you got to put the boat in the water and let it expand overnight. They didn't have to let it expand. It had been expanding for 105 years. So they took the boat into Menominee and they turned it into a museum, or at least that was the idea. And people came from all over. This boat was hailed as the greatest find in maritime archaeology around the world. It was the oldest working schooner still floating. It was a Great Lakes schooner. It was one of a kind. This is a particular type of sailing craft that they found.
That's the Waterfront Festival.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great thing. And, you know, this is what the boat looked like after they cleaned it up. Compare that with that picture we saw of the same windlass a couple of pictures ago. I mean, it was just in spectacular shape. Howard Chappelle is the name that boat guys know. Howard Chappelle was kind of the dean of maritime history at the Smithsonian. And this is what he said. This is the greatest find. This is a treasure. You know, we can put together the real workaday craft of the past, what people were actually working on. This is the kind of PR this guy was getting. The problem was he was out of money, and nobody else was coming up with money. The states turned him down. Both Wisconsin and Michigan turned him down. The feds turned him down. This is back in the 70s and 80s. We didn't have the preservation in place, the preservation tools that we now have to save buildings, to save automobiles, to save ships like this. And Frank ran dead into that wall, and he just couldn't buy a break. And, you know, he just, it got to be a real sad story. At one point, he was so bad that he set the ship on fire and stood there with a shotgun and held off the cops. And we're talking Menominee. He knows these cops. They drink in his bar. And they finally talked him down, and they put the fire out, but they ended up having to bulldoze the ship. It was completely dry-rotted. It took 15 years to dry-rot a schooner, if anybody wanted to know that. And it just got to the point where he couldn't let people on the boat anymore, and they bulldozed it and put it in a landfill. So from triumph to tragedy, it probably darn it did kill him. He moved to Florida, and he didn't live long after that. The only good part being that before he set it on fire, he called the curator at the Dawson Museum, which was at that time one of a very few number of museums that was on the Great Lakes doing Great Lake history. And he said, John, bring a truck. because he had creditors that wanted parts of this boat, anything they could sell. They were going to take it down to antique stores and sell it off at a penny on the pound. And so they loaded up a truck with anything that would fit in the van, and John brought it back, and he hid it in the back room of the Dawson because we had no rights to this stuff, and if it ever came out, you know, who knows what would happen. Well, when I came on board, I found this stuff, and I figured it had been 25 years, and Frank's dead, and probably most of the creditors are dead, and, you know, we've had it, finders keepers kind of thing. So we put it on exhibit. In this exhibit, it's the first time this stuff from the Alvin Clark has been out there, and one of our model makers had made us a model of the cabin of the ship. And you can look at the model and see the captain's door that's got these turning louvers on it, and you can look over and see the door that's got the louvers on it. You can look at the dining room table that they used to use, and there's the dining room table. You can look at the pots and pans and the clock, and we got a couple of stoves off of it, and all that stuff is in the exhibit. Now, of course, the Dawson not being a huge museum, it's not a huge amount of stuff. We've got more of it in storage, but at least now it's all categorized, it's all out there, and people know we've got it. I talked about a sea change, and the sea change has taken place, and Michigan has been at the forefront of that sea change. In fact, there's actually a mistake on this, and I'm going to point it out because I'm really proud of it. In red are the preserves that Michigan has created where there are a spectacular number of wrecks. And any place where there was an unusual number of wrecks, either because of the topography, the underwater lay of the land, because of the way the winds came in, of course the straits are unnatural because the boats used to run into each other all the time there. Over here, the big one off of Alpena is the Thunder Bay, and they just expanded that one. That's one that is even larger now. And then there's that spot down there in green that I thought was going to be an Ohio preserve. But the day it was supposed to go, the governor was supposed to sign it. Evidently, people who owned, that was right around the islands down there, you know, the Bass Islands and, yeah, put in Bay and that kind of stuff. The people who owned the properties there were so afraid that they'd never be able to even, like, wander into their beach and pick up a rock or something anymore that they didn't pass it. I thought they actually had, and I talked to somebody from Ohio, and he said it didn't happen. So Michigan's got the only preserves. Wisconsin's working on one or two, and they may get them soon. Ohio, maybe yes, maybe no. There are a couple in New York on the lakes, the Finger Lakes, and Champlain's got one, I believe. But Michigan's got 13. I mean, we're really leading, and these things are great because all the wrecks are documented, and there are some that we're still looking for, so that there are teams that go there and look for them. The preserves maintain buoys on the wrecks, so if you're a diver and you want to see it, first of all, you got a little booklet that tells you how to get there, what to find, what to look for, and you don't have to toss your anchor over onto the top of the wreck and wreck the wreck. You can tie off to the buoy, and you're all set. So that, I mean, we're really taking this to a new level, and people are doing a great job of it. We're also doing a lot more educating. This is a group that sails out of Mount Clemens. There's also a group out of Port Huron, but these guys are associated with the Navy. They're naval cadets, naval sea cadets. It's kind of a junior status, but these guys come from all over the country. They apply for this program. I think they only take about 15 folks, and both men and women, and they teach them not only things like basic navigation. And they operate as cadets. They run this boat. There are adults, captains on board that make sure that the boats run properly, but they run the boat. But they also teach them to dive, and they teach them archaeology. These guys have gone out and found, they've done a lot of diving in the Alpena Preserve. They've done some diving north of there where they've found some sinkholes that evidently have some real subterrestrial origins. There's water coming out of there that's salinated. They're trying to figure out where that's coming from. These guys found there's a waterfall up at Mackinac in the Straits. If you're going over the bridge and if you were to look down off to the east, there actually is a place where a prehistoric river ran and a huge waterfall that was just a little bit smaller than Niagara Falls. And what they went up for, and I haven't heard the results this year, they went up looking, there were caves off to either side of this waterfall, so they're looking for human habitation within the caves. And, you know, these are high school kids. This is pretty cool stuff to be doing as a high school kid. And it's also raising the awareness of what's underwater, of the tool of the great resources that are underwater, and spreading it across the country. This is a very, very well-run, well-respected program called the Noble Odyssey Foundation. And, you know, they also do shipwreck diving, which is probably, you know, after you get done going into caves enough, looking at a shipwreck's probably pretty cool. And as far as supporting Great Lakes history, there are a lot of them. The Dawson was the first building purposely built to teach Great Lakes history. Back in 1949, we opened in a schooner, which eventually rotted, and we burned it, which you couldn't do today. And we had a building built. 1960, this building opened, so we're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. Back then, we were one of about four. There was a museum over in Kingston, there was a museum down in Vermilion, and there was a museum over in Duluth. Now there's probably about, oh, I'd say 17 or 18 museums on top of another dozen museum ships on top of about 60 lighthouses. So the feeling for Great Lakes history has grown. And it's being supported partly by the government, but much more importantly, it's being supported by us. People that love lighthouses, people that love wrecks, people that love Great Lakes history. We're doing that at the Dawson. There is the Gothic room, the smoking room off the City of Detroit 3 that I mentioned, which came off the boat and then was lovingly inserted into our lobby about 6 years after the building was built. And it's a beautiful, beautiful version. I mean, if you want to see an example of steamboat Gothic, this is Gothic off a steamboat. The room has a stained glass window at the far end, which came, it was there on the boat. The room also had a pipe organ. It was the men's smoking lounge, although I've been told women go there. Just off to the side here was the cigar stand off of the Western States, another DNC boat. And it was a cigar stand because the DNC didn't sell cigarettes. They'd sell liquor, they'd sell cigars, they'd sell pipe tobacco, and they had one-armed bandits on the boat. But you couldn't buy cigarettes. I always thought that was an interesting cut. I'm not sure how they did that. A couple of the other things of note that we've got there, of course, the Dawson family was big race fans. They owned Miss Pepsi because they had the Pepsi bottling distributorship in town for a long time. So we've got Miss Pepsi, beautiful piece of mahogany. If anybody's into wooden boats, that's a spectacular one. A couple of our recovery things that we did in the 80s and 90s, we went out and found the anchor from the Edmund Fitzgerald. The Fitzgerald had been anchored down at the bottom of Belle Isle. There's a fairway there that if you're not going any place for a couple of days, you can drop anchor. And they did, and when they raised the chain, all they got was the chain. And the anchor stayed there, and they went up to Duluth. I'm sure there was another one waiting for them when they got there. But after the Fitzgerald sank, some of the folks who had been crew had told us about this, and we went out there with a magnetometer, another search tool that they use underwater, and especially on a large piece of iron. And we were able to locate it and get the support of some of the local tugboat companies and barge companies and went raised the anchor and put it there with the support of hundreds of people whose names are on the plaque around there. And we also have the pilot house from the William Clay Ford. The William Clay Ford was one of the Ford fleet. Ford at one time owned his own boats, named them after his sons in most cases. But this boat has a connection to the Fitzgerald because this is the boat that went out to look for the Fitzgerald. The Arthur Anderson had been following the Fitzgerald and is probably the most notable of the boats connected with the Fitzgerald. But there were some boats sitting in Whitefish Bay, sitting out the storm. They knew it was bad. They were down. It was about 7:05, I think, when the call came over. The guys were having dinner. The call came over and they said, we can't find the Fitz. And the captain did a quick survey and they went and raised the anchor and they went into the same storm to look for the Fitzgerald. And we've got the charts. They actually went right over the spot where the Fitzgerald was. They knew where it was. It was just way too late. But we do have the pilot house there. It's an absolutely spectacular shape. It's just the way it was when it was sailing. This is Captain Don Erickson, who was the captain that night. He'll often come up and sit in his chair and tell you anything you want to know about sailing a freighter boat. It's a wonderful thing to have, but it's also one of the best views on the river. And when the wind's blowing out of the west and the currents flowing to the east, that river can chop up pretty good. People have claimed to get seasick standing there. So, And of course, this is what we've got, part of the exhibit, Committed to the Deep. There's one of those classic old brass hardhead suits. Probably goes back about 110 years. And then there's the model of the Alvin Clark. That's what we do for Great Lakes History. And I've got a few brochures here. I didn't bring many because you guys are kind of far flung. But we like to think at the Detroit Historical Society that each of the local organizations, local communities, has their own historical society. Royal Oak, Birmingham, Ann Arbor, you know, Pontiac, Plymouth, they all have their own historical organization. The Detroit Historical Society, we kind of go Toledo to Ann Arbor to Port Huron. That's kind of our scope. And then at the Dawson, we go the whole Great Lakes. So we like to think that you guys are part of us. And if anybody's interested, I have memberships. I have volunteers if you're interested in doing that. One of my hopeless spiels, I've got to tell you, is one of the things the Detroit Historical Society did recently was produce a book on Detroit during the Revolutionary War. This has a few stories about boats in it, but it's really not a boat book. It's a book about the Revolution. If anybody's interested in the eras of the Revolution, especially on the frontier, and Detroit really was the frontier. There wasn't much before or after once you got on the Great Lakes. I'd be happy to talk with you after that. It's a really reasonably priced. But back to my spiel. One of the things we do a couple of things that support it besides just having a museum open. We have, every November 10th, the day that the Fitzgerald sank, we have a Lost Mariners Memorial that we hold at the museum. We light lanterns for the sailors on the Fitzgerald. But we've done this for years. In the past few years, we've kind of gotten a little bit away from the Fitzgerald. We realized we were only honoring 29 men out of the thousands and thousands and thousands that had been lost out there. So we've kind of switched it over. And it's now a Lost Mariners Memorial. This year we did the Marquette and Bessemer. Last year we did the Bradley, the Carl Bradley. And we try to feature a different vessel, which gives everybody a different idea of how many craft have been lost on the Great Lakes. You know, and as safe as sailing is, as safe as, you know, these big computers and big ships, we don't think they can sink. The Fitzgerald told us differently, and a few years ago we had a shipwreck right on the Detroit River when the Westcott went down. We lost two sailors there. You know, so shipwrecks are still happening. Despite all the technology, it's still sailing. Another thing we do, and this is relatively close by, we partner with the Ford Seahorses Diving Group in a shipwrecks festival, which kind of is oxymoronic, isn't it? But we do have a shipwrecks festival, and it's a great day-long program. We've got vendors there that will sell you anything from a diving trip in Tobago to the gear that you need to go looking for one of these ships that we're talking about here. They have a whole series of people who come in and give talks and lectures and show films, which actually we're going to step to right next. And it's a great thing that's happening. It's on end of February, February 27th, and it takes place down at the Washtenaw Community College. So it really is right around the corner. And it's real reasonable. I think it's on a Saturday. And if you're interested, I'd be happy to give you some more information. There's a gentleman back there named Daryl Wright. Daryl's got the blue hat, and he'd be happy to talk to you about it, too, because Daryl does this kind of stuff for a living. And I appreciate him sitting through this, because he probably knows more about it than I do. We're going to go to a video next, and this video was taken on a dive to a ship called the Dunderberg. And the Dunderberg is just off the thumb up in Lake Huron. This film was shot by a friend of mine named Tony Gramer. Tony has been diving for years and years and years. He was one of the guys that brought up some of the stuff that's in our exhibit back in the old days when you'd bring up stuff. And we've got a real nice a wheel that came up from the Eber Ward and an oil pump from the Eber Ward that Tony has lent us for the exhibit. Tony does some great underwater photography. And in diving on the Dunderberg, he had a lot of fun doing this one. He just stepped into high-definition filming. I'm not sure how it's going to translate here, but it's really nice film. The Dunderberg was a typical Great Lakes collision. You know, whether it's the pitcher hits the rock or the rock hits the pitcher, it was bad for the pitcher, and the Dunderberg happened to be the pitcher. Got run into late at night by a passenger packet, much bigger boat. Sank very rapidly and sits on the bottom in pretty darn good shape. The most unusual part about the Dunderberg, and we'll see it almost right off the bat, is the figurehead that it's got. Most Great Lakes boats, oddly enough, did not have figureheads. I know a guy who's trying to do a paper on it, and he's found very, very few Great Lakes ships that had it because they were utilitarian. You know, they were good for 5 or 10 years, 7 years if you were lucky, and then they were gone. You trashed them. You pulled them into a harbor, and you walked away. So that they didn't dress them up very much. And the Dunderberg actually has a very spectacular figurehead, which the zebra mussels and the scale have gotten to it a little bit. You can't see it so well. But this will give you an idea of what it's like when you dive. And I'm not a diver. I should have prefaced the whole thing by saying that. I'm a sailor, and so I'm really partial to staying on top of the water. Divers get to see a whole different world, and this is where Tony's living. And these guys are just on the way out. It was out near the freighter channel, so they're diving out where the boats are still running today. This would be a good time. Mandatory New Age music. They did this for about 3 days, and they didn't tell Tony they were blowing bubbles. He thought his boat was going nuts. But here they are going in. What she looks like on the bottom as Robert McGreevy sees it. Robert McGreevy, I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's worked with the folks up at Thunder Bay. He's worked with the folks up at Whitefish Point. He's very talented at this kind of thing. But you can see where it got run into at the side, and we'll see that in about 3 minutes. This kind of shows what we're going to see at the front, the cat's heads, the bowsprit. Here's the bowsprit. There are some shots filtered through here that Tony took about 18 years ago before the zebra mussels came in. So you'll see the very clean shots, and then you'll see the distorted shots. There's the bowsprit, or rather the figurehead. Shaped like an alligator, which nobody's been able to explain. It must be an alligator, Gary, yeah. But you can see how the zebra mussels have covered the chains there. And there's beautiful carving down the side of this as it wraps around the prow. Or there used to be. Slowly scaling over, slowly deteriorating. Off the top of my head, I don't know. 80, I want to say 86. 1886. You see the stock of the anchor off to the left. Anchor rope is tied off to the knight's head there. You can see one of the gaff booms off to the right. And then that would have been one of the mast steps there in the center. Fife rail is one of the things he's going to show you that pre-zebra mussel. Here we go. Zebra mussel in sight. So you can imagine in another 10 years, you're not hardly going to be able to make out the shape of it. That probably is a torch and a torch holder. The very round knob at the top would have been soaked in pitch, would have been burning at night when they got hit. The other side of what I'm thinking is a top mast is a capstan, which is, for all you sailors, is essentially a big winch. Like the bilge pump right before the aft fife rail. The main, I guess, is the three master. But you can still see the knots on the mast. I mean, they just took a tree, shaved it, and stuck it in there. I think this is where he heads over to the gash in the side. That would have been the gangway. All of a sudden, the rail ends. Kind of hit it an oblique angle there, and you can kind of see how it pushed the timbers in. Pretty big hole for letting water in. This dive buddy's coming up. Beautiful picture with the light in the background. But you can see what the zebra mussels are doing, so we really have to get down and do these. I think that's probably all we need to see. If you'd like to see more of this or any of Tony's shipwrecks, let me know and I'll give you his number. Tony Gramer does beautiful work. So this is the point where we go to questions and answers.
Well, I know that Evan Fitzgerald, we read the book before. It hit the, like, there's the...
Hit the shoal, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, that's theory number one.
Theory number two.
The Edmund Fitzgerald was in a huge storm and it caused a bit of waves. It could have caused to tip the ship sideways, and the waves got higher over the deck, which made the bell, they recovered the bell from the bottom of the sea. But
they did recover the bell, didn't they?
If they recovered it, it would have snapped off the ship.
But it didn't snap off the ship until they went down with that big diving suit and got it, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Have you seen the bell?
Well, no.
Oh,
but
you
in
guys
the books.
You guys will have to do that trip sometime. Yeah. Of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald. Everybody says, well, how did the Fitzgerald go down? And there's at least 8 or 9 very, very solid theories, and I'd say it's 3 of them. Take your pick. Somebody came up with a new one last year. One of the architects who's still around had a theory that he was busy positing. So, anyone else like to step to the mic? Don't be shy.
During the first Gulf War, Marinette Marine, which is where they raised the Alvin Clark, was building minesweepers,
uh-huh,
and tested them out on the bay, Green Bay. And I'm told that they, with the very sophisticated sonar on there, that they mapped every shipwreck on Green Bay. And it's locked away, but...
I wouldn't be surprised.
Did you hear anything about that?
I haven't heard about that one, no, but I was doing some research into the Detroit River wrecks and the St. Clair River wrecks, and there are several, but there isn't much left of them. I mean, in the Detroit River, if a wreck went down, they either recovered it, if it was any way salvageable, or if they couldn't salvage it, they blew it up. So there really wasn't, I didn't think there was much left, but I talked to a guy who works for the Corps of Engineers, and they have done the same thing. As they've been going up looking for dead cars and whatever else falls into the river, they have discovered several wrecks that I didn't know were there. Another way to find wrecks, not to get away from your question, I don't know about the Green Bay surveys. I can give you the name of a guy, though. Brendan Balliot would be able to tell you in a second. He's probably one of the premier Wisconsin wreck divers. And he also does the websites, and he also writes the papers, and he's a real historian. But if you're interested in looking for wrecks in relatively shallow water, Google Earth is a wonderful tool. If you get the right lighting, there's some just up in the St. Clair River, kind of just near Algonac and just near the Harrison's Island cutoff. And you can actually zoom in and see the wrecks sitting in the shallow water, which for us guys who don't like going underwater is great fun.
So. And then last summer I was sailing my little sailboat off Menominee, and between the lighthouse and the marina entrance, it's about a couple hundred yards off what they call Fat Lady's Beach, and about 30 feet of water, there's a wreck there that people were diving on, and I don't know anything about it. I was wondering if you...
Nope.
Okay, thank
nope.
you.
Nope. That's there. You know, like we say, there's about 4,700, and probably a good 1,000, 1,500 have been found. But I couldn't tell you which one that was. One guy had a great time up in Lake Superior. He was going out of Whitefish Bay, and he had an idea where a schooner was. And he went out. This was not this last summer, but the summer before. And he went out, and he was driving along. Because the water was low, he actually found it without getting out of his boat. He was close enough. He was able to see it. So he got all the coordinates. The weather was getting a little rough, so he headed back to go out the next day. And on his way out the next day, he passed over a second wreck that he could just see. That was a bonus day. I talked to him the day after. He hadn't come down. He was still up here someplace. So,
I've got a question on your map where you showed the areas, sanctuaries, where lots of wrecks have happened that have been designated. I don't know if that's the right term for it.
Yeah.
I noticed there was one in lower western Michigan. I'm from the Muskegon area, and it looked like just below that.
Muskegon down to about St. Joe.
Yeah, and I was not aware of that. I'm just curious what...
West winds.
West winds, yeah. What would have caused that, and approximately, did they know
there was a lot
how many wrecks there were there?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I think that one's they've identified about 20, because they're fairly long, and they're relatively shallow, too, which is nice. There was a lot of traffic down there between, south of Ludington. Anything Ludington, you just march down the way, and there was lots of traffic, and in a real hard west blow, northwest, southwest, didn't matter, they ended up on the beach or someplace, you know, in that vicinity. Lots of wrecks in that area. And Commerce, okay, West Winds and Commerce. Oh, yeah, yeah, the Manitou, and that's designated, and I think the most recent one is the Traverse City, right up in Grand Traverse Bay has just been dedicated. So. Oh, sure. Well, and some of that was getting out of the wind. I mean, these boats would head for the lee of an island, like up near Manistique, or in the Manitou Passage, or someplace in there, and they were already in trouble. I mean, they were already in a full gale. They were probably already taking on water. They were probably dragging an anchor, and they tried to look for some lee to get under the lee of the islands, under the lee of Grand Traverse Bay, and then they sunk. So, you know, that's why a lot of that is. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I have to admit that I do not know a lot about zebra mussels other than, you know, the devastation that they cause. But I was noticing on the film when he was filming the mast, and all around the base of it, you could see them. But as he got up higher, they weren't there.
I think, and this is just a guess, I think that's because it was a pine mast. And I don't think there was much for them to hang on to. It was very slippery. It was, you know, there was nothing really for them to grab. Whereas on some of the other woods, especially the flat surfaces, they had something to grab. I know that there are some metals that they won't go for. They won't adhere to that because there's some chemical action there. And I will say that we talk about the devastation. In fact, it's been tremendous. Anytime something like that comes into our ecosystem, it's a real problem. But I'll also say that I've been sailing since I was 10, and I can see the bottom of harbors that I could never see ever before. I mean, the lakes are incredibly clean, which has made it really good for pikes and walleyes and stuff that are looking for fish. They're finding it. The predators are doing a wonderful job. They're kind of actually having, there's a problem there because they're wiping out their food chain. It's so much cleaner.
So if you were to be able to go down and scrape off the zebra mussels, what then, do they totally destroy what's underneath so there really is nothing other than this group of mussels?
No.
Or is there still something underneath there?
First of all, they're pretty tenacious little rascals, even after they're dead, and it's real hard to get them off. But when you do get them off, they leave a very small footprint on the wood itself. And we had a barrel that was brought up. The police divers found it and brought it to us 2 years ago. And it just took, I took a, you know, one of those Teflon kitchen scrapers, you know, that really, so it wouldn't hurt the wood. And I was able to get most of them off. You know, so they will come off. And once you do get them off, you can almost get a perfect piece. You'll see a little pit. You know, it's kind of like an acne thing. Once it goes away, you'll just see a little little touch left. So
if a ship were to go down tomorrow, you know, in the Great Lakes, and we wanted to preserve it, is there something that you can do to it or put on it or something that would prevent that?
Nope. Nothing we've figured out yet, and nothing, I can't imagine something that wouldn't have harmful effects on the other side. You know, equal and opposite reaction, the thing you don't expect. It's just kind of, it's there. So the trick is get there as quickly as possible and get the surveys done, get the photographs done so that we've got it down the road. And who knows, in 20 years, something may come along, a little virus or something that kills all the zebra mussels. And then we won't have that problem anymore, you know.
It'll just do something else, though. So thank you.
That's right, sure. The Asian carp. Oh, wouldn't that be too good? So, yeah, Daryl. we waited for 15 years, and now it's a problem. We should have moved on that one quicker, I think.
Good evening. My name is Daryl Wright. I live out here in Dexter, and I found out about this little session here this evening out of the Ann Arbor News yesterday. And I scrambled as quickly as I could to try to put a few things together. I'm hoping we can help answer some of the questions here. I do have some material that I brought that I ran through the copy machine quickly today, and everybody here should be able to get a copy of that. First item I have on my hand here, for the divers and anybody that is interested, there is a publication. It's called A Diver's Guide to Michigan's Underwater Preserves. It has all of the preserves and the shipwrecks and so forth that are noted. The way to see one of these is if you come to the Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival, which will be at Washtenaw Community College on Saturday, February the 27th, and the brochure or the pieces of paper I'm going to pass out have that flyer on there so that you'll be able to look at this and schedule it. The sheets underneath, I deal with underwater search video, and the vessel that you saw on the screen here with the divers going off it, trust me, that is humongous compared to mine. I've got an 18-footer, and we concentrate with cameras only. Do a little sonaring, but not much. I'm planning on having two booths myself at the Shipwreck Festival, and I have a website that you can visit. This is not a business. I am retired. I'm just having a good time out here. I cover Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, and Lake Superior. Come see me at the booth and look at some of the equipment that we use. Everything that we use for the right view is designed and built by myself. I blow bubbles once in a while. Been blowing bubbles since the 60s. But there are some places I don't go. I am not a tech diver. I'm not going to the deeper depths. There is one other pass out that will also be available at the Great Lakes Shipwreck Festival, and that's the one for the sanctuary at Alpena. That is the 13th National Sanctuary. It is the only sanctuary in the United States that is devoted to shipwrecks. No cost for admission. The government, our tax dollars, has spent millions on this place, and it's a little off the beaten path, but it is one heck of a place to go.
How can you say that? It's in Alpena. No. So if you wanted to learn more about this, Daryl's going to be hanging out in back, and he will be happy to hand you whatever information you're interested in. Come by the Shipwreck Festival if you're interested in that kind of thing. And, of course, I'd love to say, come on by and see us at the Dawson Museum. Thanks a lot.
One thing I will ask, please, one of these pass-outs to each family. Everything I do is out of my own pockets. There's no funding here. It's all volunteers that make this come to be.
Thanks.
Thank you.